So thank you very much, Professor Marinari, for sitting with us. The theme of this interview series is the history of replicasymmetry breaking in physics. And before we dive into the topic, we have questions on background we're going to ask you. So first, can you tell us a bit about your family and your studies before starting university?
Oh, yeah, sure. Yeah, there is a story here because indeed I come from south of Italy, Avellino, which is a small town. My parents were in humanistic studies, and so both Italian literature, when eventually my mom became an expert of all Greek, late. But when we moved to Rome, when I was 14, I think they did it somehow for me. I mean, okay, we had cultural relations in Rome, in the university environment, in humanistic studies again, so they kind of enjoyed it themselves, but I think that was a perspective thing. So I came to Rome, I studied in Liceo Tasso, that is in these days very much in newspapers, and then I came to Sapienza. Sapienza was at the time the only university in Rome.
So what led you to pursue physics at La Sapienza?
Yes, good point. So, the choice of physics was, as I told you, I was coming from a humanistic family, right? So it was not easy. People expected from me to be a lawyer for some reason. I was talking, I don't know. But then I started to realize I kind of love mathematics. Indeed, it was a very bad professor that helped me my decision, because there was this lady, very nice, but she didn't know much mathematics, indeed. And I realized that sometimes I was kind of a bit faster than her. No big deal, very normal. But then I say, maybe. And so that gave me a will, and I had a feeling that still mathematics was not my life. And also, I knew about the school, the physics school in Rome. And this is, I think, is important, because it tells you that this kind of names that go around then eventually help people to take a decision. So I knew about it, I was reading about it, and then I said, maybe this could be the right way. And what happened? And so I went to my daddy and I told him, that I think about some physics, and my daddy looked at me and said, he would not expect that at all. Say, yes, I mean, I'm very happy, but and so do you realize you will never be rich? And so I say, yes, I do fully realize it. go ahead. And when I came here, and indeed, right ahead, I loved it so much. I was coming from classical studies. So we start calculus here, the first year, and for me it was completely new, and it was just fantastic. I bought some ski because I thought now I'm at university, so I would also be spending my time on mountains. And then kind of for 3 years I didn't go mountains because I was studying all the time, because I loved it, I mean.
So you mentioned the reputation that the physics in Rome had. What can you tell us a bit, what was this reputation and how did you come about?
To be a very good school. It was very, already talked, now we are talking, I'm from 57, so we're talking about, 76, 75, 74, 75, the moment I was deciding, 75, so center of the 70s, and already, I mean, you would go newspaper and you would read about it.
Okay.
This tradition you read, maybe about Amaldi founding CERN, about physics becoming important in Italy thanks to these people in Rome, and I would hear maybe something about Dushek and these kind of things. And people would tell that this was really an excellent environment. And I had this feeling, I don't know, it came to me, right, because I was a kid, but an excellent environment could help. This was very true.
So were there particularly memorable courses when you were here that sort of drew your enthusiasm?
Yeah, sure. Luciano Mariani gave a wonderful course of quantum mechanics. So the first course of quantum mechanics was Luciano, and it was really nice. Honestly, I didn't have Altarelli, that was supposed to be a very good teacher too. And then I got Nicola Cabibbo for theoretical physics. Indeed, it was Nicola Cabibbo that brought me first to Francesco Guerra and then to Giorgio, I mean, when we started to talk about the thesis project to work up. And so I loved very much this course of Nicola. There were a lot of drawbacks because he was teaching 8 o'clock in the morning, and that was already kind of a problem, and he was smoking a cigar. And at the time, he would still smoke, even inside the university, right? So he would come, he would go on his chair, and he would put the cigar here. And since I was a very good student, very active student, I was sitting always in the first row. And I had this cigar, a kind of 1 meter from I did it. And then I had Giorgio. Sorry, let me finish, right? Yes. I had Giorgio, and that was also very exciting, because Giorgio was finalizing his book. So it was first time, his book about Euclidean field theory. And so it was first time he was teaching Euclidean field theory and statistical mechanics. And he was even finishing book, so we kind of helped them, were looking for mistakes. And so Giorgio was also a mystery, I would call it.
So Giorgio was already...
No, he was not professor here yet. He was not a professor here. He was a very young researcher at, institution, exactly, but everybody knew he was extraordinary. I mean, Giorgio's name was really incredible known year around from when he was probably 24.
But, so he was teaching.
As
a volunteer.
Yeah, as many people from INFM teach now, right? We get many courses that are given from people from research institutions, CNR, etc. I think he had done this job. Okay, he was clearly going to become a professor. He became a professor very, very young. But then he went to Tor Vergata, where eventually I was hired. I mean, okay, he first came here to engineering department, he went to Tor Vergata. And so he had decided to do that. And this was incredibly exciting, and that indeed it brought me to my thesis work. Maybe we'll discuss it later.
So Giorgio was teaching Euclidean field theory and statistical physics, and Camillo was teaching
theoretical physics,
which was
basically the first course, E plus E minus, E plus E minus, not really the renormalization group, just up to a renormalization group. So it was the basis. Yes, electroweak model, I mean, then there were something later on, but I don't know much. But Nicola was still, yeah, so gamma matrices.
So statistical physics was taught by Giorgio in this course, and who
that was new, and then Carlo Di Castro was
Carlo
teaching
Di Castro was giving
the main course.
In basic statistics, so
yeah, the basic was together with quantum mechanics.
Okay.
So I got it taught by Luciano Maiano.
Luciano
Maiano. They did it very well. I would not be able to tell, but obviously his art was on the quantum mechanics part, but he was really fantastic in that. I mean, I was just young enough, I didn't meet people like Tushek and even Amaldi. I never had a personal relation with him, while Salvini was, for example, very present. Yeah, and then so Giorgio offered, because I've been talking to Nicola about my thesis work, and then I've been talking to Francesco Guerra, that indeed was following me also when I did his thesis with Giorgio. I mean, he was working also a bit with us. And but then Giorgio, during the course, one day I was starting the thesis, he kind of told me, no, so I would have maybe this new problem, would you like to work there? I say, yes, I mean, I knew who Giorgio was, because people knew. I went to do it. And then Giorgio, this is just amazing, because that was other professors were present. And then Giorgio came to me and said, you know, Enzo, I want to apologize, because, you know, I'm not a full professor. So I offered you to tutor you. But I don't know if that is appropriate. I don't want to put you in any difficult situation. Maybe you would prefer someone else. I said, Giorgio, How could you imagine that? I mean, so, but yeah.
And so De Castro in his course was teaching StatMech also a bit of disorder or not? There was
no, there was nothing about nothing. Disorder. But I can tell you more, it will come. I spent maybe 10 years of my scientific career without knowing about disorder. There will be a story that would be interesting when David Gross came to Europe, but I mean, this comes. I was working in particle physics, the thesis in statistical mechanics, because I was working on Wilson ideas, and then very soon I loved numerics very much, so I started to a lot of numerics, and then there was other approach and so on. But Giorgio, at this point, was still a particle physics guy, very angry, I mean, it was just starting, and then you see my production on the side of statistical mechanics that comes.
So how was the group functioning, right? Were there group meetings? Were there seminars? Or how was your interaction? You were just talking one-on-one with Giorgio? Or was there a community of people?
No, A lot was one-on-one. So Giorgio was a young guy, huh? With the 76, it was less than 30, I mean, something like that. And then two things start to happen slowly. One, people from abroad start to come for spending 1 year, 2 years with George. Marc Mézard is one of them. Changi Cheng came, and it was fantastic because, I mean, this guy was coming from abroad. Indeed, he had spent already maybe 1 or 2 years in Germany. He was already very accustomed, I mean, but still, right? Changi Chen was getting notes in Chinese on the Chinese paper written by Giorgio when he wrote Stochastic Quantization, because Stochastic Quantization was written with Wu during a Chinese trip of Giorgio, and so it was published in Chinese. And for us, this was very, I mean, exotic again. We are talking about 80 or 79 or what it is. The Spanish friends start to come. Luis Antonio Fernandez was the first, and then everybody followed. And then in Rome, we started to have a little group because some researchers from particle physics decided to start to work with Giorgio. Mariella Paciello, Verne Arnau, Massimo Falcioni, Bruno Taglienti. So that was the start of the group. But at the start, and much of that was really a personal interaction. Giorgio had many personal interactions. Mm-hmm. I will show you not all of them, but in my research, it was just working with Giorgio mainly.
So around Cabibbo there was a group of people.
Yes.
But there was no formal group.
I was talking to you about the group that was created around George. Okay. The story here, I mean, more recent time, it started with Gatto, and then Gatto had very good students that were called the Gattini, the little cats. So there was Maiani, Altarelli, and then Cabibbo, then Gatto went away. And Cabibbo stayed, and Luciano Maiani was already crucial presence here. And there were people around them. Nicola has always been, say, on his own. Again, many collaborations in different situations, many talking, many doing things together. But he never had the real, okay, then he did the upper project. That has been a huge group, obviously, so, but it has been an organization, okay, but at a level of, on the contrary, there were researchers in particle physics, but they've never really been part of my direct interactions, but for the one, again, that moved, that was 8, 10 years later, I mean, for the particle physics I started, but we go to that, many of my interactions. Yeah, we go to that because it is statistical mechanics, I mean, in Saclay. So when I moved as a postdoctoral fellow to Saclay, I started to work with a group there, and document people, but maybe you want to know later.
So you mentioned how you started working with Giorgio on your Laurea thesis. What was the project you were pursuing? What was the ideas that were?
Yeah, I mean, this is just it has been fantastic because so the project was say solving QCD, okay. Ambitious vast program. Giorgio was really understanding Wilson's ideas. This was a really, the problem that it was crucial. I mean, somehow Wilson had done his work by having the presence of computers now very clear. And his work was potentially numerical from the start. And Giorgio had that clear. So Giorgio had taken a point, had this idea that he could do it. And so we started. And we started to start with punched cards, to program numerical simulation by Monte Carlo methods of lattice QCD, but was completely new route we were. And indeed, spin glasses will enter now in one moment, because when we started, we say, very good, we do QCD. And we start working, and indeed, it was really difficult. And then Giorgio say, fine, well, let us do this little approximation. We take away internal loops. So we just, internal fermion loops we take away, okay? And we just leave external lines and see how this works. So in my thesis, basically, we propose this kind of approach, but it's called quenched QCD. Why is that called quenched QCD? I don't know. But because Giorgio started this flirt with glass system in some sense, and then this idea of quenching. Okay, so quench QCD is a QCD in which this feedback is eliminated. And again, I was very sad to say, oh no, I'm doing something mad or for my thesis. I mean, that was absolutely ridiculous. And but then we did that. So somehow, it was numerical simulation of QCD, also trying to include fermion loops, but introducing the idea that you take them away, and computing observables.
I see. For the subsequent decade or so, you worked on various problems in lattice gauge theory and QCD. Can you give us some ideas as to what was driving the research program? What were the questions that you were specifically pursuing? Yeah.
You see, in our kind of pioneering stuff, it was really a new problem of statistical mechanics. I mean, there have been two basic motivations, as you say, right? So, at the start, the crucial one was, this is something new, can we understand this kind of Monte Carlo simulation? There were good people in molecular dynamics here, for example, Giovanni Ciccotti was very important person. Giorgio was talking to him very much, I became his friend. Indeed, when I went to Paris, I was living with him for a few months. And there was interaction, I mean, the use of Langevin equation in some situations. A few ideas, and also we'll go back to it probably, all these tempering ideas. Indeed, they are umbrella sampling, basically. So these were things that a little bit in the field of molecular dynamics and Monte Carlo, more in the solitude things, were known and used. So this has been, yes, this is also thanks to Giorgio very much, which has always been able to talk to many people. So that was, say, the first motivation, but behind there was also, will it be one day a phenomenological tool? Then now it is. I mean, in this sense, it has been a triumph, if you say, right? Because these ideas now really work like a practical phenomenological tool, you know? And when I started here, you would go into the department, you would hear Magliani, Cambibbo, and confinement of quarks was really a maybe. I mean, people were really not sure at all. Indeed, all the stories about preparata ideas, for example, he was not convinced, he was here, he was not here anymore. when I started to talk to Francesco Guerra, when Francesco Guerra came here from Princeton, he was working on constructive theory, and Cabibbo told me about Francesco Guerra, saying he's the person that will explain confinement. And because of Georgia, it was led astray, but I mean, still. Now, you see, this is not an issue anymore. Because of numerics, so the fact that it's clear that there is confinement, nobody would discuss it anymore. It is just. Also, I tell you, when maybe it was kind of still from the start, I started to also work on problems in statistical mechanics and disorder. And when you want, the first was the paper with Ruel in Paris, the two papers with Ruel in Paris, for example, but maybe I can elaborate later if you want. Okay, yeah. So, because then, you see, I never got a PhD, I don't have a PhD because we didn't have a PhD in Italy, so our Laurea thesis was longer and you would go out of it publishing at least two or three papers, and then you would go as a postdoc, which is what I did. So I went to Saclay, and Saclay was generically a wonderful place, right? Brezens, Berry, Sixon, but I was more again in a particle group, so working with Alain Billoir, André Morel, Robert Lacaze, Anna Kluber-Stern. But I was talking, for example, with Sixon, who was very useful. I will comment about this paper on analyzing phase transition by numerically determining the young zeros. I did that first when I was there in Saclay. Sorry, I don't remember what was I talking about.
No, you said you wanted to talk about the papers.
I'm back to it. So, Giorgio was visiting and he was somehow going to IHS because he spent a few months there, and he started to talk to David Ruel. And then David Ruel's idea had some ideas about Sinai potential, and so we wrote a paper together about the behavior of Sinai potential and of the power spectrum of Sinai potential. Indeed, recently then, because I met eventually Gleb Oshanin maybe 10 years ago or something like that in Santa Barbara, and he was working on that. So we done also, I mean, this led me recently, but I mean, 30, 40 years later, to anomalous diffusion analysis and so on. But so, this paper with Ruel was maybe my first real jump in disorder, because it was a disorder system, and it's also true that in lattice-rich theories we were doing a lot of work on phase transitions, because at the time there was really the problem of qualifying the statistical behavior of the system, also the confining transition, but generally.
So the idea of the work with Ruel was to learn more generally about statistical physics and phase
transitions. Yeah, but somehow Ruel has this idea about the behavior of spectrum of Sinai potential, and we kind of did numerical verification, numerical work, and we discussed that. We did together this argument, and yes, it was somehow an argument about Sinai potential.
As you were, also
Paul Windy was in this paper.
You were mentioning earlier you got very much involved in numerical work from early on. Can you tell us a bit what that meant, right? And maybe the evolution
also
of the technology.
Also because it leads us to up and to Janus, and also that you have to tell me when you want to discuss. But so again, it started with punched cards here downstairs.
So there was a computer in...
Yeah, there was a computer downstairs. Eventually, there were boxes when things were improved. At the start, I think it was an IBM, and it was punched cards, so we would go down with punchers. And while I was working on... I just ended my first code. There were really different types of programming, right? The first box arrived in Frascati. So, box meant a friendly operating system and the fact you can program on a screen. That was completely. So we started to go to Frascati. Okay. We'll go with George. And I remember one night we done something. George was very excited. And George was driving. And so we get the car, and it was really raining, cats and dogs. And so we're in this car with Giorgio driving. It is, I mean, it's okay. Giorgio driving in the night. The glass of the car was completely fogged. And Giorgio was writing the equation because we're trying to eliminate this determinant, right? To bring this determinant to the numerator, basically, while driving on the glass. And I remember me thinking very clearly, I mean, I love so much physics. Do I want to die for that? And I remember the answer to myself was no. Still, I could do that. So I smiled and I continued to. So we will go to Frascati. But this is interesting because when I went to Saclay, the first Cray had arrived there. Indeed, it was in Cadarache at the start, so we would work remote. So I had a Cray. Okay. It was a bit like being an experimentalist in this sense. Because you see, you would not have internet, the very slow modem were not even coming, I'm talking about 81. So we would stay till 3 or 4 in the morning, because also the computer was empty in the night. Guido Martinelli had the same experience a bit later on with the same Cray. So that was a bit our attitude. Then, in the same moment, when I came back, people started to discuss about APE, the APE project, this dedicated supercomputer for originally Lattice QCD, but eventually then it was a spin-glass computer to the Twitch. So we wanted to use that, and somehow there have been two factors. When Nicola Cabibbo and Giorgio Parisi were both felt in love with two different aspects of this story. So Nicola loved hardware. Nicola Cabibbo loved hardware. In his basement at home, he had built a automata machine. That was an idea by Toffoli at MIT. So Toffoli had built a machine like that, and Nicola thought, I can do it. And he did it. Now it is in George's office in this moment. Okay. And in the same time, Giorgio had got in love with compilers. He started to buy books about compilers, optimization. You see why, okay? Indeed, his first tool we had built together was an optimizer for APE. It was something that was shaking operation. Hopefully by preserving the meaning of what you wanted to do. Okay, so Giorgio and Nicola started to talk. Nicola was important politically because he was the head of NFM, then became the head of Enea, so was able, APE has been a big Italian project that went to success because of incredible real competences of Nicola and Giorgio, but also because it was able to have political support big enough to have him pass a barrier. And you see, I had some experience with the Cray, also that I started before, because even before any my thesis, maybe I had been in Edinburgh, where there was David Wallace, there was Peter Higgs, and they had started to do things about parallel computing. And they bought this computer called MassPar, that was just a stupid parallel computer, meaning it will execute the same operation all together for all its processors, right? APE is a big story. APE is an ape, and the idea is that it is powerful but not so clever. Why? Because we didn't want a computer that would do, this is the idea of GPU basically now, that can do many different things at the same time. It was enough for us doing the same thing in parallel many times. Because at the end, your goal is to multiply matrices, okay? And this is a bit less true for spin glasses, but still, you know, you have lattice structure and this helps you, so you can do things. So there is this kind of stupid parallelism, but then you can build a computer. So right ahead, I entered in this program, but then also, yeah, I clearly liked algorithms from the start. I mean, my thesis was a bit on algorithms because this idea of simulating QCD was to find algorithms. Right then I started to work with Nicola Cambibbo on this algorithm to update SU3 matrices by using SU2 embedding. And we looked up a powerful algorithm indeed. So I liked that. And so Lattice QCD has been for 10 years a very happy place for me. But then I was slowly starting to follow Giorgio. It's very difficult not to follow Giorgio. And start. So if you look at my curriculum, see that it's disordered papers appear, and then more and more, and then there is 1 year, maybe a bit later, 93, maybe order of 30 years ago, a bit less, from which I moved completely.
Before we move to that, I mean, you mentioned your interest in computers. Were you at all paying attention to other special purpose computers that people were developing? Let's say O'Gale's keys machine?
Sure, yes. We were both competitors and also colleagues. I mean, so we are learning. Needed to start, it was more Baumgarten with IBM, Norman Crist at Columbia, and something else probably, it was a lot of time ago, I'm sorry if I forget someone, and sure we were following. I mean, it was really a very intertwined thing about this fact of having computers and of understanding and realizing what Wilson had in mind. Mm. Because again, I insist on that. I really believe that Wilson had very clear this idea of numerical implementation, and that this is one of the real axes of what he did. But then he didn't do numerical implementation, so this had to be done. So then there was Ogieski, and then we start with the Spanish friends. I told you about postdoctoral people coming and so on. And so we were good friends of many of these people. They first built a computer that was called SUSE. And then somehow we decided to do something together. Now I'm jumping something like 15 years or something. And that was the Janus project that was born for studying spin glasses. And then the real problem of this computer has always been a bit the software. I mean, it has been easier to build a dedicated, very effective hardware than to build a very general purpose software. Also, I must say, we have been able to do all that, APE, Janus, because there was a window of opportunity. So somehow it was a moment in which very willful people like us could give a real contribution. Now it would probably be very, very difficult if you go to something very special arts.
I want to take you back a bit to the late 70s, early 80s, because as you said, you were very close to Giorgio at that time, which is when he first formulated the ideas of replica symmetry breaking.
Yeah.
Were you aware of that happening? Was it being discussed or?
Not so much.
Okay.
You know, at the start, really not so much. I mean, this place was particle physics. There was Carlo Di Castro, Gianniona, clearly, I mean, so there was an excellence, a clear excellence in statistical mechanics. But the bulk was particle physics. And Giorgio was one of these particle physicists at the same time doing that. But again, but it took 10 years. And so I can tell you, for example, when David Gross visited Paris, when he did the random energy model with Mark, right? I was in Saclay, mm-hmm. And he was working in Connor Mann with Mark on random energy model, and in Saclay with me and with Alain Milloir on random surfaces. That was a moment in which people wanted to understand Polyakov ideas, and so what about the discretization of random surfaces? And we wrote a paper about that. We didn't understand the right thing. The right thing, the important thing was that you need to also integrate over triangulations. This is crucial because this preserves all your different Wolfram invariants, and if you don't do that, things don't work. Things work, but don't do what you wanted to do. I mean, Sacha Migdal, Ambier, and François David understood that. But we wrote this paper, it was very interesting. And I mean, because you see again on the side, that was string theory in this case, but I mean, of the particle physics stuff. And I didn't really, I mean, I didn't know what he was doing with Mark, I didn't even know he was working with Mark. And so this is a typical example, right? So I started very slowly to approach the field.
Okay, so there was no seminars, there was no presentation where you would have heard of...
To start, not much. No, clearly when I went to Paris, then yes, right, so I started to know, but if you ask me, when I was doing my thesis this year, no, then in Paris, yes, I was exposed.
So, yes, I also while talking to Roberto Benz the other day, I kind of understood that the... action, let's say, on disordered system was mostly taking place in Paris at the time.
Yes.
So Rome was really particle physics, and so Giorgio, if I understand well, was not talking much about disordered systems here. He was talking to people in Paris.
Exactly.
That's how
it took a little. Then eventually, clearly things changed.
But why? Because instead, in the group of Di Castro, there was interest in disorder. They were working on localization.
Yes, Di Castro.
So there was no interaction. They also there was a workshop in 81.
Yes.
Where I think Di Castro and Giorgio were
co-organizers. Yeah, there was not much interaction. You should also remember that Giorgio has done crucial work in particle physics. So. I mean, at the time, Bragg, Paltarelli, Parisi, and all the grand unification potential stuff. I mean, many things, right? But then, and the smooth transition with Bresen, Sixon-Zilber, and with fixed dimensional regularization, and so on. No, Giorgio Di Castro, indeed, already was a statistical mechanics group in some sense, because then he very fast went to strongly correlated systems. So now, Giorgio, no, but then Giorgio was a fan prodigy of particle physics here. So you see, his position was peculiar in some sense. So it took him a little more to start talking about this idea. And when he talked, he was a very good friend of Carlo Di Castro, but it was a completely separate world.
So,
I just had something. You know, with Roberto Benzi, for example, Angelo Urcani and so on, there were relations. I mean, Giorgio were discussing a number of things. Yeah, for example, Fermi, Pasta Ulam, and other names that I tend to forget, but I mean,
they're
important. Yeah. We did a paper about equipartition in the system, because again there was a quite complex idea about it, and on that, for example, people were coming from Florence already. I mean, people Angelo, Roberto were very present.
So fast forwarding a bit to finally disorder. From what we can tell, it's in the early 90s with a PhD student of yours, Giulia Iori.
Yes.
That you start to work on disordered systems.
Yes, indeed, if you, a little bit before, but you are right, because I have reanalyzed that. It was indeed something like 93, the moment in which you start to have a complete transition. And this is also the moment where we propose the tempering approach with Giorgio. Because somehow we had this feeling that for numerical in disordered system you needed something more. I mean, we realize that we tried it. You get a normal Monte Carlo, get an Edward Anderson model, and you just go nowhere. Right? It was not clear before we tried. Giulia was our PhD student. Indeed, Giulia was even something more. Because she was, my entrance in disorder system, but it was also Giorgio and my entrance in the biologically relevant problems. Mm. Because we studied polymers, proteins, and so on. with Julian.
So what brought you to these problems?
Giorgio.
Okay.
No, clearly I was interested to that, right? And I started to do numerics more and more about this kind of projects. And when Giorgio, that was a few more as a period when Giorgio wrote his first paper about the immune system. It was too early, as Giorgio would say, but right, Giorgio has this phrase that says, you discover a thing if you are the last person that discovers it, not if you are the first one. Because after Columbus discovered America, nobody could discover it anymore, and because the name is there. And so that was a bit too early for a real discovery, but so we have studied that with Julia. Julia is now a full professor of economics and finance in Venice, on leave from London, where she's also a full professor, so she did a very brilliant career. APE was quite advanced at the moment, and indeed we started to work. Also, at the time, the other thing I was still doing a lot, that is a part of my career, are things about random surfaces and quantum gravity. So we did main simulation, again, from the work paper with David Gross. So I worked with Mark Bowick, for example, and other people. And that was also approaching more and more, say, a full immersion in the disordered system, is the disordered system stuff, right?
Can I ask one thing? When you started, so let's say in the early 90s, when you started this work on simulated tampering, what was the situation of the community on the debate about the finite dimensional spin class? Because I think there is a point that we don't understand. There were simulations of spin classes throughout the 80s. Most simulations were done, I think, in the US. So, and I think David Hughes said that for what he remembers, up until the late 80s, there was no attempt to understand numerically finite dimensional spin glass using LSB.
Yeah,
he remembers that most simulations were doing like droplet-like analysis. So do you remember what was the situation before you arrived in the field?
No, so we probably started that, but you see, okay, first thing, the situation was tense. Meaning
that, I think this is my question.
In what sense?
The situation was tense for or for theoretical reasons or why?
Yeah, there was a tension about these two different ideas that were supposed to be not very amenable one to the other one. It was very difficult for us to publish on physical review letter. They would not let you. I mean, it was a very honest, bona fide, interesting, funny, scientific battle in the best meaning. The tension was based on conflicting theoretical pictures. Indeed, from where we started numerical simulation, it needed to have tampering because it was you could not do anything without an optimized Monte Carlo method. From a static scalar, that's what you see. Let's say zero magnetic field. I don't want to go now in finite magnetic field because I don't know. But in zero magnetic field, it was clear from the moment we were able to do these simulations. Better situation is replica simulated breaking luck. There is no doubt. Because P of Q has a large number of peaks, because you can easily establish that this is not due to interface that appear and disappear, and so on. So indeed, from when we did one simulation, I think for me, again, I think it's different in finite magnetic field. I'm not completely convinced of what happens here as soon as you put a small magnetic field. But in zero magnetic field, numerically looked clear. Then you can say, fine, this is not asymptotic regime. Why not? We can discuss all that. Also, the new facts, meaning that experiments indeed move on a finite time, infinite, in small length distances, because when you look at more advanced experiments, you have never more than 1 million spins that are really interacting. That means in three dimensions, the correlation and of order 100. So you have to think about this type of thing. But in any case, so you could have said, fine, numerics say that, but when you go to large lattice, something will change on a 1 million cube size lattice. But from what we could see from the start, it was very clear. Situation.
But so this was in your simulation, let's say, at the early 90s. But before that, what were people saying? I mean, do you remember what was the status of the debate for the computational?
I don't remember this. Nobody never saying that from numerics you would see something droplet-like. I mean, from bona fide numerics of the model itself, clearly you get Migdal-Cadan approximation, you get droplet. Okay. My remembering the story is that before we started, there was not much on numerics, maybe more dynamical stuff, right? Computational dynamical correlation, function of dynamics. Surely nothing but to tell you Trigiedov Anderson behaves like droplet. I really don't think so. After we started, basically everybody's found what we found. Then you can do different analysis and user to try to show that it is not really true. Many numerics could do something different, sure, they are delicate problems, but...
So the heated debate of the 80s was mostly based on theory arguments, that's what you remember?
Yes, but we're never talking to each other.
Yeah.
So there was not a meeting where people met or discussed, or there was a... He said, well, they're not talking to each other. This was all through the literature, and it's all only papers?
Yes, preprint.
Preprints.
And referee reports.
Yes, and referee reports, obviously. Preprints, and okay, there were probably, there were meetings, people would talk, but I think it has been very, I don't know, because two groups, a different area. No, we have been talking a lot from the start to many experimentalists. So Vincent, Ocho, for example, all the people trying to do a very, very interesting thing. It's still now, we work a lot with experimental groups, and I think this is one of the very important parts. Let's say there were people, right? Mike Moore, David Hughes, David Fisher, basically, and they were doing excellent work. Okay, now maybe the problem is this is theoretical, it's a theory and it's very difficult. The renormalization group's computation were done by people of the two sides. So Mike Moore and co-worker on one side, Imre Condor, Temesvari leader, and so on the other side of Giorgio, obviously. And these people would talk, for sure. So there has been common ground.
And why did you decide in the early 90s that this was the time to attack the problem numerically and not before? Because Giorgio was following this debate before, right? So why
you needed to have a Monte Carlo method that worked, and we found that in 92. I mean, again, this was
so the, you were looking for it.
Not really. I mean, numerics was less common as a tool of choice, right? For particle physics, we had introduced it. People were doing molecular dynamics, but it was more like a phenomenological tool, let us reproduce experiment in some sense. So this idea that numerics would be the basis for theory and would be able to have strong interchange with theory was new. was completely new. So we started to think about it, but it was, probably the 90s or something. Computers were very small. I mean, you could do very little things. So probably having the API computer helped, because after working a lot on QCD, we thought we could use it also for stained glasses, maybe, and indeed we did, because we obtained a lot of results about that. And then we started to think about optimized Monte Carlo, and there the presence of Giovanni Ciccotti here was very important. I met many of the people, because again, I was a good friend of Giovanni, many of the people that come visit him, and maybe seminars, and that would be an interchange. And then there was this idea of parallel tempering and of tempering, but again, was not revolutionary, because it was brought somehow from another field. But in our field, it was revolutionary. Indeed, this is another lecture, I believe. Talking to people in different areas, now maybe it's becoming a bit easier and a bit more common, but it's not trivial at all, because different fields develop different languages, and to recognize that something is the same thing. So bringing all this body of work from molecular dynamics, something very similar to our statistical mechanics or disordered systems, was not easy at all. And after tempering, everything went fast. And to say the truth, and we can go maybe later, come back to it. Now we're a bit blocked again, probably because of temperature chaos. But this is physics.
So as you brought up tempering many times, so I'd like to dive a bit specifically into this. So the idea or the motivation for looking at simulated tempering was to study spinning glasses explicitly. Is that correct?
Yes, for us.
So yes, you were looking...
Indeed, if you look, we tried random finitizing model just because it was easier, but it was for spinning glasses from the start. I mean, the idea is that it was clear, but there were barriers. It was clear that Monte Carlo would not pass a barrier. How can we be smart and pass these free energy barriers? So that was completely clear. Other groups were doing the same, right? Because it was Fukushima. I think there were many old groups reading the literature in this other field and trying to bring it, to us.
How was the work received? I mean, as you said, there was many other people who were working on similar ideas at about the same time.
I think very soon it was clear there was an effective way, but indeed, when this parallel tempering, but there's been a little bit of fight on priority, on the name, is still on, but I mean, very friendly, I must say. So that became very soon, because also statisticians, people in statistics were working on that. Mm-hmm. So there are contributions from them. I mean, it was a moment in which we really touched people doing this work from the fundamental point of view for them.
So how did the realization that all these ideas were very similar take place? Was there a meeting where you all met, or was there...
No, just the papers.
Just the papers.
Yes, just the paper. I think I have. That I never met probably the other people. I mean, I can have correspondences or so papers, and then they started, because then very soon people started to see this could also be a way to do optimization in an effective way. I mean, Beyond was there, Spinless Theorem Beyond was there, and that means that it was known that optimization was important, and so, yes.
So, at about the same time as you worked on these ideas, the idea, you started studying models that had self-induced disorder as well. That quench disorder.
Exactly, yes. The three papers with Felix and George. Right?
So where, what drew your interest in these models and that possibility that you didn't need quench disorder?
I don't know. The Bernasconi model looked very interesting, right? Because it was this clean statistical model where it was so difficult to go down in the free energy landscape, okay? And then somehow there was this intuition, clearly, George has been. crucial at that. But indeed, this could be a way to apply RSB ideas to situation in which disorder was not quenched disorder, but was dynamically creating itself and creating glasses. Mm-hmm. Went to mind, I mean, right ahead. So also, you remember, I mean, this random matrix model, Giorgio was a real expert. Because so, Giorgio had worked in the French environment so much about them. So very soon he started to connect about all what he knew about that. Mm-hmm. And this is what came out.
So were you aware of the work that Mézard and Bouchot were doing on very similar ideas at about the same time? Was there a discussion or...?
Probably yes. I never discussed that with Mark. Probably, I would say that very probably Giorgio would have discussed that with Mark, but maybe later on.
Okay.
So these things were going fast sometimes, right? And it was competitive in the good sense. And so, no, for me, I remember that as a very intense few months work on a precise issue, we need clarification, but I'm pretty sure that Giorgio probably would have discussed it with Mark, probably when things were done.
Because this is, I think we're asking this because this is something that another thing that we don't understand, that there was the work of Kirkpatrick, Tirumalai, and Molines in the late 80s, from 87 to 89, in the US.
Yes.
And for what we understand, they were not talking much to other people, so it went largely unnoticed. And then in the mid-90s, like 92, 93, there is a rush in Europe where it seems that everyone wanted to do models without quench disorder to do glasses. So there was your work, there was the work of Bouchot and Mézard, there was the work of also Kurchan, Cugliandro, and so on. So what happened? I mean, why? Soon,
I mean, all these people involved were very much in contact one with the other, right?
But why it became suddenly interesting to do this kind of model? So, did you know about the
Giorgio?
Work?
I mean, there was a bit of this idea that for getting a Nobel Prize, spin glasses were not ideal, and then glasses would be far more. But better.
Okay.
So this was present. Indeed, I remember talking to Nicola Cabibbo. Nicola didn't appreciate Giorgio working on glasses.
Okay.
He said, indeed, on that, I mean, Nicola had a wonderful taste in physics and in general in life. See, on that, probably, he had this idea that. He was saying, you know, the glass community is too large, is too close to engineers, they will never really recognize him. Giorgio is throwing his time away. And that was wrong, I believe. But I understand very well why he meant that. But somehow I think the main idea was spin glasses are a wonderful technical accident. This technical accident maybe will be precious. For what can it be precious? By the way, Giorgio never loved application to, he loved optimization, for example. Also, biology was always a bit, he entered because then we did RNA, DNA, etc. But he loved better, in any case, of fundamental problems. So glasses, in this sense, were the obvious choice, right? Because glasses would bring you to a world of interest for many, even too many, maybe, and would be a very relevant contribution.
So the idea was to find an application of LSB within physics to a fundamental problem in physics, okay?
Yes, if that could work.
And so did you know at the time of the work of Kirkpatrick, Tirumalai, and Collins or not? It seems that they were really not No,
I did not too late. I mean, I don't know. I cannot tell you exactly. No, when we wrote these three papers, no, surely this is not something we account for.
And they were not in touch. So they never wrote to you. You never had.
No, not to me.
It seems that like Peter Vonnegut was visiting Europe at some point.
You went to Paris.
Point. Huh?
You went to Paris.
He went to Paris, yes. In the late 80s.
No, 93,
94.
So it was already after
moment.
The...
Yes.
So you were already working on that problem?
Yes, it was when I think this problem is, because I noted Saya, this was 94, 95. Mm-hmm. So it's... but no, it was more like, yeah. Mm. Yes. But then George was right, see. But yeah, you see that very well. Indeed, you're right. About the emergence of numerics in this field was at a very clear point when it lasted a bit, when now we have to see what will happen. And again, I will repeat that there has been two main ingredients. The computers, the powerful computers that you needed, and the algorithms.
So we were talking a bit about the computers just before, right, and the algorithms. So can you tell us a bit how the transition from Apé becoming a simulation of spin glasses, how did that take place?
Yeah,
or how,
so Apé was doing two things. So Apé was a project that went very close to being an industrial project, because Nicola cared, we were four generations. So there has been this line, and that was mainly Nicola. Then there was the line of programming on Apé. Basically, I think what happened is that we did Lattice QCD as a statistical mechanics problem from the start. But I think Giorgio's interest was never to really do the phenomenology. That was, on the contrary, the real goal. So there was a moment in which Guido Martinelli basically took the lead for making of Aperance a real phenomenological tool, weak interaction physics, computing things you could not access in a perturbative way. And at this point, for us it was a bit less to do, because the fundamental questions had been in some sense clarified. Also, it started to be clear that you could implement interest in numerics with spin glasses. And so, at this point, we started. We evaluated the fact that it was possible, meaning that Apé could be a very reasonable spin glass computer, because somehow the number of data you would have to process would be enough, and it would work. It would not be as good. I think we were losing, I don't know if a factor 2 or 4 in the performance compared to Lattice QCD. But in any case, it was such a fantastic tool. But, and so we decided to go ahead. So we wrote a program, and then very soon we started JANS, meaning the Spanish-French crowdfunding, and that was completely different because it was an FPGA-based computer. I mean, okay.
So, but relative to the simulated tempering ideas, that happened at the same time that you moved to Apé, or this was before?
Yeah, it's exactly the same period. I mean,
okay.
Same time.
Okay. The same ideas and the same drive.
Same ideas, same, yes.
So, getting back to the finite dimensional spin glasses. So we're trying to understand. So when you wrote these first papers in the early to mid 90s, what was the response to? I mean, how did that fuel, or how did that interact with the debate on from a theoretical standpoint? Was there immediately some pushback, or was it accepted?
Again, the Doppler replica signal breaking dispute has never been very open-minded, I would say, on both sides. So these results were clear, I mean, they were correct. But then you have interpretation. So somehow it will always be something like, yes, numerics look like Shelton Kilpatrick, but, and maybe, but there are interfaces. It will be always a bit defensive, a bit attacking. I mean, so you would do new simulation, for example, or the idea of analyzing small observables in small cubes that grow, so not global observables, right? But cubes grow in such a way to. So it was fun, it was interesting because you would use theory to think about new numerics you could do to answer to theoretical questions of people that did not think about it like you. So that was more challenging. But it's about never led to contradiction, I believe. So at the end, we'll see. Again, blocked probably by temperature chaos, because now after so many years, we cannot do something larger than 32 to the cube, because you cannot really thermalize. And it looks quite clear that this is because of a physical property of the system. But from what you can see, the situation is quite clear.
So in a review in 2000, you mentioned the importance, I guess from a theoretical standpoint, of addressing the difficulties highlighted by Newman and Stein through your work, through the simulation work. Mm-hmm. How did the conversation with Newman and Stein in particular take place? So again, only through the paper trail, or were there meetings or visits or conferences?
Many papers. And yeah, there would have been some meeting, but this is only mainly papers. It's really something that has gone through papers. So we would read them, we would study, we would think, we would study, we would think, we would try to find things. This is what I just told you before, mm-hmm. right? So we would try to find new numerics to answer to doubt. And for a moment, it looked, before Nicholas Reed, it looked like Newman and Stein were a kind of RSB killing, right? Then it's not like that. I mean, that on the contrary, Newman and Stein has been very important mathematical work that can go in the opposite direction, minimally substantial to prove that all these things have sense. But at the start, it was not like that. So we would somehow try to understand how could they not be true, and to come with replies. I mean, at the same time, clearly we were talking to mathematicians, we were trying to prove Guerra and Talagrande. I mean, yeah, with Guerra we would always be talking a lot. Mm-hmm. So Guerra has always been very present and close to us, discussing, trying to prove that Parisi's solution was right. That was not clear. Even George, I believe, you know, before the mathematical proof, was not completely convinced that he had the correct solution. And even eventually waiting for Panchenko about ultrametricity. Every detail was, when George's solution was the right thing, roughly was clear. But the correct solution was another story. And rigorous mathematics has been used.
So, as you mentioned a number of times already, the numerical simulation of finite dimensional spinning glasses became its own research program, yeah. Right? As through Janus II, and which persists to today. Right? But how did this come to develop? What led this to become a big enterprise?
It was something you could do, right? It was something you could do. It was something that was giving results. You know very well, a normalization group is very difficult in these systems. Okay. So very good and smart people, Cyrano de Dominicis, spent even all their life doing that. But being completely sure of what is happening is still an open question. So now what would you do? What would you do? I mean, okay, you get dropped. Yes, there is a drop. We know, we understand. You get replicas in the breaking, very express solution. Then what do you do? It's obviously that in this scenario, you need very good idea to do weather normalization group from a theoretical point of view. You need new approaches, I mean, M layers, clearly George is putting energies on that, introducing, but then numerics, you have it there.
Yeah, but also, what enabled such a large program to exist? I mean, this is it's a lot of money, right?
Yes.
So, for one thing.
But yeah, there has been some Spanish funding that has been important. Giorgio personality has been crucial. It goes in many directions, because, for example, all the Spanish young researchers that came to Italy eventually go back to Spain. Victor Martin Mayor, Juan Ruiz Lorenzo, Luis Antonio Fernandez, I told you already, Alfonso Tarancón, they eventually came back to Spain, become full professor, and become relevant. It's always, right? Giorgio years, Giorgio capability of interpersonal relations, and then these people started to find. So, for example, I'm telling that because, for example, Janus came from dedicated Spanish funds.
Okay.
In Italy, it was more difficult. Because in Italy we did APE, because there was Nicola, and so on. But then it's not trivial to get money this way, meaning there are computer scientists that would not always agree, they are very open mind, but still, I mean, it's because you asked specifically about a powerful research program that needs money. So, for example, with Spanish colleagues, but they become important in the university, in this field, that believed in this project, have been instrumental. There was BIFI. BIFI is the center in Saragossa. I've been director for physics of BIFI for a few years, more than 5 years. BIFI was from the start a very interesting experience of something with complexity, network, and quantitative biology. Alfonso Tarancón has been instrumental in creating it, again, I directed it for a few years, I directed the part for physics, and they put a lot of energy at that. So, this is about the kind of construction that came out.
So EU-wide funding was never the drive, it was really more Spanish?
No, this has been more Spanish, so somehow APE has been more Italian, and it's been Italian, fully Italian. INFM has been very important in the APE project. And Janus has been more Spanish. You see why, right? Because there are no computer scientists. So it's a bit of an anomaly, right? And in order to get the money for it in this anomaly, you need a strong presence on the field. So somehow the local field is a bit more adapted. I mean, I go to a funding in Europe to a computer science school for building a computer, I don't have any chance.
Okay. So we know that you taught the disordered system class at La Sapienza
for many years. Yes.
So can you tell us about the genesis of this class? How did it come about?
I've been teaching it, I don't know if close to 20 years, and now Federico Terzenghi is teaching it.
But you created this class, right? It did not exist?
Kind of. Meaning, so let me finish one phrase,
okay.
Because now I'm teaching what Giorgio was teaching, I mean, teaching critical phenomena, statistical mechanics phenomena. Giorgio had had the idea of teaching this class, and he had introduced it, but very different from what I eventually did. For maybe 2 years. So, because he was teaching already critical phenomena, he could not teach too much, he had a bit of his idea. But then he was not very convinced about putting an effort on it. So when I came here, because okay, when I became full professor, it was still a moment in which people in Italy would have, many times, would have to move to become full professor, and it was better because you could become a full professor earlier. So I went to Cagliari as a full professor when I spent a few years. And then, so I was in Tor Vergata as an associate professor. I went to Cagliari as a full professor, and then Giorgio in the meantime and moved. He was already here in Sapienza. And then after a few years, they gave me a chair in theoretical physics here in Sapienza. And I came here and I was thinking about what to teach, and since there were no, I mean, George had proposed something, but he didn't have the time and the will to develop it, I say I could introduce that. And then Francesco has been my wonderful student.
When did you start the class, the first year?
Listen, I came back in 99, maybe 2001, something okay. like that.
So before then, basically, disordered system were not part of the curriculum?
No, again, Giorgio had started maybe for 2 years to do a course on which he was not focusing.
Because Di Castro in his class, he was not doing at all disorder.
No, Di Castro was more field theory and strongly correlated at this point. Right?
So the students that would eventually work with George, or where did they get their training before you started your class?
They would get a course from Giorgio, and then they would just learn.
By themselves.
Yeah, by themselves. Well, I introduced something quite, organized, and very much a diluted system, random fieldizing model, spin glasses. With things like, for example, I would discuss supersymmetry and palissy-Slavov. It was always very nice to the students, because clearly here supersymmetry is something particle physics, mm-hmm. much, right? And while students would see, it is not an easy computation, but it went more or less I was going through. And
so what was the reaction of the department when you proposed that? Were people happy or?
There was no problem. There was all. They never wanted it to be a compulsory course, but I never wanted my course to be compulsory courses. Because I like that the student comes if he likes it. I can be even more advanced in this way, that if it's compulsory, you have to. So they were friendly, not enough to say every student in statistical mechanics should take it, but I have many students all the time, so because students were interested, and indeed I think all young people that now are professor here have taken it. Federico is not young enough.
So did you taught about spin glasses before teaching this class, or was this really the first time you yourself?
Giving a course about spin glasses. It was first time. I got seminars, but a course really, I conceived it from that. And I've been putting together material. It was not trivial because I had to select something that I could present to students mm-hmm. in a reasonable way. And I wanted something still quite advanced. So, for example, writing the Parisi-Surla in a way that I felt was both, say, rigorous enough and accessible to students, that was not completely trivial. You remember the Parisi sulla paper is one page and that. It's a PRL with one full page and one. It's nothing you could approach a student. Then there were something done later on, but still, I completely did also. I would not do, for example, replica symmetric breaking computations. I would do in detail all the replica symmetric computations.
Okay.
And then I would give, I would discuss the physics of replica symmetric breaking, but there was no time in 60-hour teaching for going up there. So these I would not do in detail, but I would do things that really, I had the feeling the student should be able to get completed.
Maybe another subject that you could tell us about is how computational physics emerged as a subject in the teaching here.
Yes, this is indeed very interesting, because we wrote this book, but that was very much related to all the history of this department, to Cabimbo and Parisi, and their passion for hardware and software. So that gave us an imprinting. right? But give us a way to do things. Giorgio himself has invented a course of C++, that he called Programmazione più più Programming Plus Plus, and he has given
he
it.
Did that?
Yes. He has given it a few years.
When?
I don't know, maybe. With dates I'm very bad.
But more maybe like in the 90s? Or
no, later on. Later on.
Okay.
2005, okay. From 2005 to 2015, wow. Something like that.
Because when I was a student, it was not, he was teaching programmability at the time. So I think
okay.
Maybe it's after that.
Maybe just after that. But he invented this course and he gave it. Now we're trying to have someone teaching it back, because having someone teaching it. Well. So, but let me go back to my answer. Indeed, I had this idea, that has been something, that this thing that had been built here, this peculiar approach to computers, to physics and computers, deserved some dedicated teaching. Mm-hmm. So I got in touch with Federico, Ricci Tersenghi, and with two colleagues that are in particle physics, Luciano Barone and Giovanni Organtini. Okay. And we started to think about a book that would really teach students by teaching them how to program all the problems they are studying in physics or mathematics and mathematics at the same time, trying to be quite general in such a way that could also be useful out of physics. And again, there was very much this idea, that was really what we thought about, that we would want to understand everything about the computer. So, learning how to program, but learning how a chip is done, how a register is done, what is the speed of a communication bus compared to the speed of a central processor. We were looking at him as the antiparticle of an Excel course, right? So, something in which you really learn how this tool, computer, is done, and that helps you a lot in order to use it for your work. Okay, and that's why we wrote a book. And then in this book, there are all parts of this kind, and then we go very close to statistical mechanics and even to disorder systems. There are Sinai potentials, there is random walk, and there is optimization and percolation and Monte Carlo. And I think this has been something good in this department. Was this course already on when you were a student?
No.
Okay.
No.
So you taught the class a few times and then you wrote the book, or you wrote a book and then you decided to teach it, or?
Yeah, I think it was just we wrote it at the start.
Okay.
Exactly. I think it's more we wrote a book and then we taught it, or.
There had been no tradition of teaching computational methods in physics before that.
There was really nothing. Also, computers were far less important.
Sure, sure, sure. Okay.
For me, I remember I had 2 hours of Fortran when I was a student in the course of laboratory. Nothing was there. But it's true, the world changed, and we tried to take this out. I think this has been something good. It worked. So we have now this for the last maybe more than 15 years, close to 20 probably, 2 courses, one first year, one second year, that are completely connected. And then the students can program a language. It is not the most important part, but we understand what the computer is.
So we're approaching the end of our discussion. So is there anything else you would like to share with us about this era that we may have missed or overlooked?
Let me see. There are some number of contributions. Okay, about two-dimensional spin glasses, that may be... yes, about two-dimensional spin glasses. Also, maybe one thing we should quote, are all the biological application of all that, because eventually I started to work more. So both neural networks and dolphin models, and both application of statistical mechanics, not really replica symmetry breaking, but is really the path Giorgio designed. So I've done a lot on metabolic networks. I've been working with Terry Wah, for example, indeed in two different phases. We did a problem of alignment many years ago, but then more recently we've done something, modification of flux balance analysis, using constraint that make it far more physiological and allow you to understand far more, and other system, complex system based on microRNA and interactions in biological systems. So somehow I think this is worth maybe to remember, because it's, again, it's not strictly the replica symmetry breaking, but it's the application of these ideas of statistical mechanics in disordered environments and complexity to a world where they can be very important. So on these I've done many efforts recently, and now again I'm more on off-field models, I mean neural networks.
So your connection to biology, I mean, I've never heard you describe yourself as a biophysicist, so where does your connection to biology...
It has been intense for a period. It has been intense. Talking to biologists is not easy. I have a feeling that computer scientists are an easy niche. See, talking to them is easier. For a number of reasons. So at the end, I've been working mainly with physicists. Andrea De Martino has been a crucial relation, you know, he's in Torino, he was here. Olivier Martin in Paris, that eventually really moved to a plant laboratory. So together we really approach, but I've always done that more like a physicist. I mean, I've been talking to biologists and they're delightful people, but it's not easy to build a real interaction. I don't know, maybe I didn't study enough to describe myself as a biophysicist. I tried hard, I must say, but again, you know about these things. But eventually I see someone that does physics. But yes, I've applied this idea much to biology. And indeed now, the way I'm trying to look at neural networks is a bit of the same kind of approach. I moved a bit of interest, so this is the fancy, right? So flux balance analysis and metabolism, microRNA interaction, and now I'm doing a bit more of off-field models like stuff.
In closing, do you still have notes, papers, or correspondence from that epoch? And if yes, do you intend to deposit them in the physics department archives at some point?
Yeah, I have some things, probably not so much because email came quite soon at the end, not so soon. No, but I have, for example, things of APE period, some initial log books, they are interesting. So yes, everything I have, I don't think it will be much worth to store, but everything could be worth to store, I will surely deposit there, everywhere I can deposit, and I'm very happy about it.
Professor Mariani, thank you very much for this discussion.
Thank you very much to both of you.